Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. As I sit down before you with only an inkling of what I'm going to talk about, you know more than I do if there's a title on this video. I'm smoking a Fuente Natural. It's a Churchill version of an 858 Natural. Beautiful light stick. You guys like to smoke, but you don't like to get punched in the gut. This is the stick for you. Of course, if you take any light stick and you herf it real fast, you can get yourself upside down. But just drink some sugar. 60 seconds later, you'll feel way better. So I've been trying to get the research done for Project Blue Book, but it's a big mess of claims, and I don't want to do a crappy video. And the History Channel has pretty much usurped the whole thing, which for me means there's something behind it. Again, the U.S. Senate committee was like, oh, what if someone lies about UFOs? Can we press legal charges against them? Really? Because national television says all this shit's real, and you're saying it's not. I've been looking at a lot of moon stuff, and I dare not try to do a two-hour, you know, an hour and a half on this today, but maybe we should just dive off into it anyway. The absurdity of the moon claims in 2022 is really just so palatable, isn't it? You know, it's sort of the difference between that moment in your life when you're like, oh, that thing, it's just on the tip of my tongue, right? It's just, oh, what was that thing I was going to say, right? And it's a fleeting thought, right? That we have all of those little instinctual pings when we see a lot of the moon claim stuff, because it's just made of voids and claims. But when you're a kid, you're used to voids and claims because you're a child, at least for me. And if you go back to the 60s, you had voids and claims because you're an adult that doesn't know anything about rocketeering, astrophysics. You probably, depending on your career, especially since women were home raising children, doing the most important and difficult job on planet Earth, which is now consummate to being a fucking slave, which is just, wow. You wonder why our world's turned to shit? That's one of them. So there's a bunch of holes in everybody's knowledge. So they just say, and then it worked. Well, we did a bunch of studying, and then it worked, right? I mean, it's almost, we just had something put in everybody's body that's literally ending their lives. And it's because of voids and claims. Nobody understands it. And they're living in the voids and claims of our life, right? They're living in the voids of our knowledge. And then they make a claim about the void. And then we're like, okay, you know, studying's hard. Reading a book is hard. And so I was looking at maybe just covering. We'll bounce around a little bit. You guys dig the subject, and it is on me like crazy. And again, we're going to do another evidence overhaul. And sort of the goal of the other episode that hasn't been created yet will be to create something super clean that you can pass around. And I'll try not to digress into other worldly events, which is my secret weapon in this entire show. But it'll be just as many little factoids claimed or debunked. I mean, I think there's a few things that they threw out there that they know aren't what the conspiracy people say they are, so that they have a way to walk into a facility that's debating this and wait for someone to throw that at them, and they go, ha, we planted that one. We planted it. So, hey, that one, you're wrong because of this, this, and this. There's not too many. But I was just thinking about the lunar lander is probably the Achilles heel of everything we've ever seen, and there's two reasons for it. The Saturn V, although filmed to be one of the most massive Titanic rockets ever made, and it's not a little rocket, but the stuff that we launch today dwarfs it. It really does. It's not that big compared to what we do today that gets off the platform. But as long as the Saturn V's took off and disappeared, then they're good. They won that little PSYOP. But the service module, the one that looks like the bullet with the little cone on the back, which looks just like those movies made in the first decade of the 20th century, based on H.G. Wells, in one case, the bullet. How funny that they homaged the bullet. But the lunar lander is really, just from its very conception, especially as compared to the better conceptions of landing mechanisms that have been the faux story of landing on Mars from 93 up, or these balloon mechanisms and all this other cool shit, that, for the 21st century, seems like it made a little bit more sense. They got a little more computer power to test ideas. Still not enough atmosphere to pull off half of what they say on Mars, especially a helicopter taking off in 1% atmosphere. Oh my God. But the lunar lander is really just a funny looking junk pile of shit. We have a t-shirt that was a suggestion by Tim, our moderator. It's called Really. And you should go get a copy of it if you love this conversation in public, because it'll be someone looking at that t-shirt and going, what's that mean? Really? And then some people are going to get it and go, ha ha, got you, right? And you guys can be comrades right off the bat, to coin a Russian phrase. There were several iterations of this lunar lander thing built. They tied them to ropes and slung them down from the ceiling to see if they could actually land on sandy surfaces in a sandbox without tipping over. But every single time they did it, of course it tipped over. And the mechanism / absolutely laughable faux physics of tying this model to a rope and then slinging it down to sand should in itself tell anyone who understands the claim of that type of travel and the mechanism and the choreography of stage one, stage two, all the way to that moment. It's not going to come in anything like the rope. Not even remotely like that. So why test it in a manner that would never be the case in terms of actually sending it to the moon? And what's really funny is, I don't know if humanity is going to survive its current phase. I really don't. And if they don't, then this will never happen. And this history that you and I are living today is going to be erased, just like they perhaps did for the Tartaria phase of things, regardless if that's the correct, you know, history of the last reset, that may be a lot more recent than we think. But if we were to survive this, if we were to nut up and do something and stop following fucking letter movements and that kind of shit, we could actually get to a point, maybe not in my lifetime, but in 100 years, 200 years, imagine we actually get a way to get up to this thing floating up there. And if it isn't just quicksand and electricity and a plasma ball in general, and there actually is a surface that's got some girth to it, which it looks like it does, at least enough to hold some 2-ton thing. I don't know how much the thing weighs. It depends on what you put inside, right? Especially an 800-pound car or 700-pound car. It'd be interesting to carry it up there and then just let go of it and have a 10,000-pound thrust motor on it and just see anybody trying to land that thing without dying. It's too bad we can't create like a UFO vehicle made of a quarter-inch thin aluminum. I think this would be an amazing scene in a Marvel movie where some villain's calling out, quote-unquote villain, calling out the truth. And you create some sort of gravity well vehicle that's attached to it, right? So it's attached to it. And it says, here's the thing. Maybe it's a donut ring around this little spaceship. Or maybe you even simulate the service module. And you take one of those things out of the museum that's telling you that they actually went through the Van Allen belts with it. And you take Neil deGrasse Tyson, Bill Nye, the douchebag guy, head of NASA, anybody and all the astronauts that are still alive, and you trick them and you bring them to this location with a big press conference, and you tell them it's going to be celebrating science and the NASA Ames project, right? I shouldn't say Ames, but the NASA project are going to the moon to commemorate them. And then what you do is like some Tony Stark dude opens the door because he got this crazy vehicle ready to go. And he says, right there, gentlemen. Right there, gentlemen, is a giant version of the technology you used to go through the Van Allen belts, through solar radiation, and land on the moon. And that vehicle that's surrounding it is actually fully capable of pulling that off. It's an anti-gravity vehicle, most modern technology, and it will go to the moon. In fact, it's been there several times. Let me show you some footage, and you prove that vehicle can go to the moon. You go, now, inside are a bunch of plush seats, and William Shatner, you're in there too. Bunch of plush leather seats. You can wear a spacesuit if you want. We got them, but you don't have to. You can go in your pedestrian clothes. We'll guarantee you that there's oxygen in there, that it's going to be pressurized, that it's going to be warm. We'll even got some champagne and donuts for you in there if you want. But our challenge to you is this. Walk up that ramp, get in that vehicle. It has the exact amount of shielding as was provided to you when you first went to the moon. And Neil, Bill, you get in there too, because you keep telling children that this is what happened. Now, they all know. They all know they fucking lied, and they all know they're lying, right? And maybe Bill didn't know he was lying until that fucking moment, right? Because he can't even figure out what a boy and a girl is, right? And now, we say, get in there, we're going to close the door, and we're going to lift this thing to the moon. And we'll let you touch down, and we'll open the windows up, because there's windows all in it, same type of windows you had in the other vehicles. Out of all the astronauts that's still alive, which probably is a handful at this point, you all get to go to the moon again, according to your bullshit story. And Neil deGrasse Tyson, you get to go for the first time. And Bill, the douchebag guy, gets to go for the first time. Anyone else, head of NASA, all these people who say they keep landing on Mars. Oh, we're going to put Elon Musk in there, too. Hell, put Donald Trump in there. He keeps saying we win, too. Not so much, guys. Got a backache, got a stomach ache. Oh, your doctor said you shouldn't, get up 10 feet off the ground all of a sudden, right? You got some ailment, because as soon as we put that vehicle through the Van Allen belts, you're going to be cooked, and you know it. You know you're all fucking liars. So why don't you look into the camera and tell everybody just how full of shit you are. Sorry for the French, but come on. Hell, we can even send the vehicle to the moon and back, videotaping the entire event, in 4K, hell, 8K, whatever you need, while we're having the little dissertation, just to prove that it went there. Tracked by perhaps the best telescopes, best optics, whatever. In fact, even simulcast it down to the ground, because we have new technology to bring that home. Not Nixon making a phone call to the moon with no delay. Right. But the lunar module is just a joke. It's a construction joke. I used to think, okay, I can give props to the Saturn V rocket. You have to. It took off. Now, for those of you worried about rockets that do turn and immediately start going over the ocean, the trick there is this. According to the theory of being on a ball and going in orbit around a ball, with even ethereal, especially with ethereal gravity, which is a push and not a pull, you've got to beat the Earth. You've got to go out on the curve of the Earth and beat it. When you start falling back to Earth, you've got to be going so fast that you fall around the Earth. That's the theory. So a Saturn V or a Falcon 9 or whatever, the space starship or whatever, it taking off and turning is exactly what it needs to do. So don't get that completely confused. I mean, if you think you're on a flat surface, I understand. But just, you got to use their technology and their theories to explain things. And that one does pan out. You can't just go straight up, because then you'd fall right back down. It's just, that's the way it is. You may be, if it's truly rotating, way off when you come back down. And that doesn't seem to occur, guys. It's just weird when a rocket goes up 125,000 feet and suddenly falls like within a quarter mile of its launch pad. I mean, come on. At some point, you're starting to drift because the world's turning underneath you at a very fast rate. But there's people out there that, and I don't think they're being quite literal about this, because I would use pipe and I would weld it together. But when they came up with this this object called the Lunar Lander, there were several prototypes made. What's really weird about those prototypes is the prototypes they built inside warehouses were actually much more impressive looking. They were contained. But I think the theory was is that they couldn't get that to take off in the Saturn V and get to its destination mathematically. So they started realizing, okay, you can't have a lunar lander that's, say, 20 times heavier because it's encased in lead and it's encased in all kinds of protective shielding, especially if you aren't going. You just build some ridiculous looking object. But they, and the thing is, I don't want to lose myself. I lost myself once in the last episode. I'm very cognizant of that afterwards. Nothing I can do about it, though, but a lot of movies made in that time frame were spending money to make things look sci-fi. A ton of them look super silly. A ton of them will steal, you know, outfits from Forbidden Planet and even soundtracks from Forbidden Planet. My God. I watched some sort of scary movie the other day. It was like in a house or something, and they were literally playing the alien music when the monster invisibly walks in to the Forbidden Planet quarantine area by the spaceship. The flopping noise with the theremin and stuff. And it's like, oh my God, this is a sci-fi soundtrack in a horror movie. So I think that they built this thing to look scientific. Always a theory behind why there's a choice. I mean, Jesus. Remember there was a show in the 70s where they would give someone an object. They give them like something like this. And it's a weird thing. It's old. It's an old object typically. And then there was, I think, three to four panelists, and then some guests, two guests, I think, at the time, playing the show. Well, the panelists would pick up the object, and they had already seen it backstage, and they've got a script that's been handed to them to lie about what this object is. So let's say there was four. So three out of four will lie about what the object is, and it's very convincing. But one of them actually has the original idea. Sometimes the object looks so bizarre that the lies looked way more feasible and practical in explanation than the person telling the truth. And so the guests would get it wrong. They'd have to guess who's telling the truth. I forgot what that show's called, but that was a really fun show. I don't think it was on the air that long because there's only so much crap in the world you could point at, right? So when someone doesn't do any research and can't make connections like the old show connections where they said this is made because of this and its predecessor and its predecessor and its predecessor, they buy anything that's laid out, man. Hook, line, and sinker. And it's sad. But somewhere in there could be the truth if the entire project was the truth. But when the entire project is a lie, everything that's being explained is only theoretical at best, right? It can only be theoretically close to the truth. Why do they put, what is it, copper shielding or gold shielding or whatever the hell it was? I think it's copper shielding on the legs. There was supposedly a static discharge element to it. But if you've never been there, then you don't have any real need for that. It just makes it look fancy. A lot of the shielding, supposedly, on the outside of this thing was all crumpled up, flat black painted, sort of really thin sheet metal at best. They didn't have the decency to weld this thing closed. So you have a lot of sheets that aren't even connected together if you really pay attention to the photographs. Why is it all crumpled up? Why? It's not like you're going to the bottom of the ocean where you're experiencing massive pressures. It's not like it in itself has a pressure behind it that when released in space is going to somehow expand. That'd be a dangerous design, don't you think? Now, we've talked about this sequence of events that ends up occurring. The thing that'll blow your mind, and it'll probably switch with some Mandela effect at some point, but the service module is the tip of the Saturn V rocket where the capsule is, right? So you can see outside or whatever. And then it goes back to the bullet, then there's the cone, and then underneath that is the lunar lander. If I remember right, it's even packed upside down, if I remember right. But whatever, when it gets in space, traveling at least 17,000 miles an hour. At least. The last known speed of the Saturn V package is 17,000 miles an hour when it leaves Earth's orbit. Now, the absurdity that they were actually able to use like some sort of slingshot theory to escape Earth's gravity is a complete hoax in itself, right? You need a constant burst of power on one half of the slingshot if you're not coming towards the space body. When you got a velocity and you're going towards, you got to burst and burst and burst and burst, and there's no such thing in the Saturn V platform. Big lie. But in space, there's no such thing as brakes. Once you're going in a particular direction, a particular speed, you're going in that direction and in that speed until you hit a medium by which you can exert an engine on the medium to create a pressure against yourself. So if you don't have an atmosphere, you can't slow down. You could rotate a rocket with a cone and blast your ass off, and ain't nothing going to happen. Because you're not pushing off anything besides yourself. And that doesn't work, does it? Right? You can't be in space and push on your chest and somehow make it across the universe eventually. You can't. You'll simply be pushing on yourself. So you got this craft going towards the moon. 17,000 miles an hour. There is no mention, especially when I was a child, that this thing was going to do a slingshot thing and reduce its orbit to the moon. In fact, every drawing ever pitched to us for the first probably 30 years, if not more, after they did these missions, showed a perfectly circular orbit around the Earth and a perfectly circular orbit around the moon. It doesn't work like that. And you know it because the Cassini and all those supposedly reconnaissance satellites around planets, they now draw it correctly. But they can only account for that happening at the receiving end. SpaceX saying that they're sending things somewhere else other than Earth. Okay, we've got to build a big-ass payload of fuel to continue bursting one half of the slingshot to keep expanding its orbit so that eventually you let go and you do not give it anything else except a big blast away from Earth, if that theory could even happen. But the service module and the lunar lander connected together for cubic feet is so tiny, meaning the gravitational force around Earth, I think it's ethereal, they think it's phenomenon, okay, why don't you go with the guy who doesn't have phenomenon definitions in his science, right? The Earth is 3.6 billion times bigger than that payload. If they've told us the truth about how big the Earth is in the first place, right? So let's say we forge all that. We give them that first half. We tell them right to the face. We know that's all bullshit that you're able to leave Earth's orbit, especially in fucking 69 or any time before that, Apollo 10, Apollo 8. But let's give you that. Even if that was the truth, is how we start the next sentence. You're now heading at the moon. And any tiny infinitesimal mistake in trajectory with an object that is on average 236,000 miles away, you're going to either miss the moon or you're going to plummet directly into its surface. Okay? Getting in a perfect acceptable window, and there is probably a wide window of getting into a potential orbit, 17,000 miles an hour, it's just this base speed that our rockets seem to get at that point in time. We didn't design a Rocketdyne F1 booster to send a certain payload to the moon at a particular speed such that when that payload hits this window on the moon, that it then locks into orbit. No, that's just as fast as our engines went. It's like buying a car and saying, oh, we built a ramp, an Evel Knievel ramp from one side to the other. And we got a car that has an engine with a fixed speed in it. We designed the engine and the car on one day in one place with no knowledge of the ramps. And the ramps were built with no knowledge of the car. And guess what? This car hits that speed, and that's the only speed it hits. As soon as you hit the boosters, it ramps up to 17,000 miles an hour, whatever it is, and it hits that ramp. And if you didn't just happen to know that that's how fast the car was going and how much the car weighs and what its aerodynamics are, it's not going to hit the other ramp. It's either going to fall short or go way over, and the guy's going to die inside. Unless he can eject with a parachute, right? So the whole idea that the Saturn V platform was just masterfully engineered to get that particular payload, not any other, again, they put 700 pounds more on it when they took, was it Apollo 15, when they brought the lunar lander with them, supposedly? They bragged for the first, three missions that they couldn't possibly bring anything extra with them because it just couldn't handle it. And all of a sudden, magic happens without redesigning the boosters, without redesigning the platform, without taking out 700 pounds of crap off that lunar lander. Magic happens, right? So, as I was saying before I got interrupted, when this is traveling towards the moon, at some point, that lunar lander who's behind you in the service module, you're on the tip of the service module, the tip of the bullet. Lunar lander's on the other side of the vehicle, behind you. Somehow, magically, they break apart and they rotate in space and then reconnect with the lunar lander on the front of the trajectory, right? So it's got to be on the front because you've seen the footage where that thing drops down and turns and retro rockets and goes down. Now, again, there's no atmosphere. There's no atmosphere. So those little drink shaker retro clusters, retro rocket clusters that are supposedly rotating this thing in space. Yeah. What's it pushing off of? Nothing. So what's going to happen? Nothing. There's a void of your knowledge. They make a claim. And you can't defend yourself because you don't know that they're full of crap. There's no reason why you would in the 60s. I mean, honestly, it's just tantamount to someone walking in a Masonic lodge and conducting either some science that looks like magic or some magic out of thin air, and you're like, oh my God, this stuff is real. Plus you want to believe, don't you? So they had a version of it with five legs, and they had a version of it with four legs. Four leg, one, one. In the overall platform design. But now it's going 17,000 miles an hour. Over the surface of the moon, as verified by all the footage. All that horrendous mock-up footage of the moon's surface, where the clay that they put on that big sphere that they built that prop out of in NASA with a railroad track on it so they could do, you know, some nice rotating the thing and then driving the camera by on a rail. Yeah, like a big dolly shot. It was all exaggerated and absurd. Mountains that were, you know, would have, at that elevation, would have been just tiny imperfections in the surface, are suddenly ridiculous B-movie Ed Wood looking crap. It's like Mars Needs Women movie, right? But everybody wanted to believe it. And then they fur it up too, right? They film it, they play it back, they're like, man, that looks too crystal clear. So we got to do a couple extra things to it. One, let's film it through a window. Let's even steam the window up to create a little bit of interference. They don't have digital technology at this point. Then what we're going to do is we're going to broadcast the movie on a wall and then film that to knock it down even further. Perhaps we'll copy the negative several times to add more noise to the negative, making it look authentic. Of course, it ain't clear, man. It's on the moon. But now you have this object, and it's descending to the moon's surface. Its only mechanism, according to their faux science, are these retro rockets that won't do anything without an atmosphere, and a 10,000-pound thrust engine, which can't possibly slow this vehicle down from 17,000 miles an hour. Until that rocket plume can somehow touch the actual fuel fire to the surface of the moon, because there is no atmosphere. There's no atmosphere, which is what we would do today. If a rocket were to come down today, like in one of those old 50s B-movies or the bullshit out of SpaceX, right? It's got oxygen it's pushing on way before it hits the surface. So you could technically use the oxygen as a liquid medium to slow it down here on Earth. But there is no atmosphere up there. And every once in a while you guys come to me, are you sure there's no atmosphere on the moon? Yeah, I'm really sure. Because it's crystal fucking clear from the surface of the Earth. And if there's any atmosphere of any kind, it picks up light. It would create haze. And even though it's very far away, we can still see it crystal clear. And, you know, even the most minute 0.01% atmosphere on the moon would start fogging up the light registry as we start to photograph the surface of the moon. It wouldn't be crystal clear like it is. So there is jack shit up there, okay? Wherever that thing is, right? But again, we're using their science against them at this point. So isn't it interesting that the, SR-71, when it left Port Hueneme, I think in 1989, I was actually awakened that morning to the sonic booms of it hauling ass. Actually, it could have been 1990, if I'll think about it right. But I remember hearing it fly from Port Hueneme to New York in 59 minutes to prove a point. Now, technically speaking, as I grew up, I thought, oh shit, that could be a psyop too. Why? You just take two SR-71s, paint the same number on the tail fin, and one goes up out of view, and, you know, it's counted off, and the one that lands, you know, launched from a few miles away goes up and then lands in New York, and, you know, you really didn't make the journey in 59 minutes. But again, let's use their science against them, right? Apparently, the GE engines that are in the SR-71, I know there's a few different brands, but you have to pretty much throw the engines away once you do that kind of push. You have to service it down to the nut and bolt. That's 3,000 miles an hour? 17,000 miles an hour. What do you think would happen if the SR-71 approached the surface of the Earth at 3,000 miles an hour straight down, or even at an angle? What kind of mess would that be? If it literally crashed into the 405 in Los Angeles at 3,000 miles an hour, it probably isn't inconceivable that a piece of its debris might land in Orange County some 30 miles away or 10 miles away. At least, right? I mean, you know, an Abrams tank can shoot you from, what, 30 miles away? Okay. Or further? Okay. So, 17,000 miles an hour, and you have a 10,000-pound thrust engine? I just think that just as a gumshoe rocketeer, you'd probably want at least 1,000 pounds for every 1,000 miles per hour you're going, right? So, 10 covering 17 is pretty hilarious. But here it comes. And it's going in a arc straight towards the surface. But when you see the footage of that thing landing, the lies just start projectile vomiting out of the footage. One, there's no footage of it turning sideways like the old Lunar Lander video game. Okay. And blasting out the engine, even if they could convince you that no atmosphere is going to solve the problem. The rocket engine pushing on itself creates a proprietary gravitational force, and it applies to the entire universe, which has absolutely no knowledge that you're even there, because you're not connected to it. Ethereal winds, sure, but they're not dense enough to create that sort of resistance. If you had a gravity well engine, oh yeah, no problem. No problem at all. But we don't. So what would we see out the window had they actually turned it sideways and actually blasted it sideways? Even if that's some ridiculous claim they might recently make with their rote memory computer in there, right? Well, out one window, you'd be seeing the moon's surface. But there's some other interesting things about this. What would stop the lunar lander from spinning? What would stop it from spinning? Making a slight error in your little retro rocket theory? Why do rockets that go up in the air often spin in circles to the point they have to throw out this sort of sling and ball thing to stop it from spinning so they could take some photographs before it falls to the ground. Well, whatever they did in the lunar lander, they don't seem to be doing in a lot of the lesser rockets that are out there now. So imagine that thing, okay, in six supposed successful missions, not to mention this re-entry back up to the service module, which we'll get to in a bit here. If that thing ever started spinning, it could be going hundreds of miles an hour within a split second because it is going 17,000 miles an hour. And I don't give a shit if you want to tell me that thing dropped 7,000 miles an hour. Why would it? What's it hitting? Angel power? Angel dust? Angel atmosphere? Stuff that doesn't exist to slow it down? Oh, someone told me that the slingshot theory around the moon slowed it down? Really? Is that what it does? Is that really what it does? Does it slow down when it slingshots? Does a vortex actually have a slower speed towards the center of the vortex or up on the edge? Princeton's top scientists, physicists, were submitting the theory that if light ever traveled down into a vortex, that's when it could hit a faster-than-light combination. So I guess they're wrong, too, about vortexes. Hughes' presentation went worldwide about 20 years ago. So you got these four legs. You got this unit down below, which is supposedly where all the environmental systems are, and this rocket that has a 10,000-pound thrust engine. But above that, you got the living quarters, which holds your computers and your toiletries and all that good stuff. Not really. But, you know, you got a big suit that makes you 3 foot thick, by the way. It's all inflated on you. Got to keep the place warm. Got to have enough battery power somehow to keep this thing going a long time. Oh, but I know they had little solar panels about the size of a suitcase. Wow. Where the hell are those solar panels today? They can keep all that equipment going, including a phone call with Richard Nixon. How much energy would it take to actually send a beam back to Earth without any delay? Traveling faster, well, probably as fast as a speed light, I would say, to have that phone call. Yet when you talk to certain people on planet Earth in the Asia from America or Asia from Europe, there's a delay. Televisions. Television interviews with the most modern technology in 2022 still have delayed conversations that frustrate the shit out of you when you watch them, right? And it was only the interaction between two people on that technology that revealed it had a problem. I built an online music studio for a famous rapper once. And he wanted it to be possible for musicians to harmonize together over the internet live. And we kept trying to explain to him that if we had an unimpeded signal traveling at the speed of light from their place to our place, that might be possible. But just the microphone going down to the computer and going into the operating system and then coming back out to the ears was creating a 35 millisecond delay, which every artist notices. 35 thousandths of a second. These guys can notice that. After building our own little jack to return the signal immediately without going through the operating system, we got it down to about 11 milliseconds, and that was acceptable, although some of the dudes could feel it. And that was 2010 technology. But Nixon made a phone call with virtually no delay. Interesting, right? Lies, 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 lies. So here it comes. The moon surface is coming up. What do we see from NASA as proof that this thing landed on the moon? And I don't know, I think this stuff was nearly broadcast live, I think, which is a joke. The amount of energy it would take to broadcast this back to Earth would be palpable, all right? What do we see? Well, they had a camera out the window, didn't they? Camera's out the window and shit is flying everywhere out from under this vehicle. Dirt is just boom, 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 just flying all directions because that makes sense to the layman. Would it? Well, on one level, yes, of course it would. If you could get the engine close enough to the surface that literally the ejection of the liquid oxygen mixture that has its own atmosphere built into the fuel. It can be lit a fire and it blows out. It's just particulates of fuel hitting the surface of the moon, which I assume is made of some sort of ash, right? And it's ejecting it away. Yet when the lunar module hits the ground, it's not going 17,000 miles an hour magically. So that is all lies. Now, I had someone tell me that the theory that NASA put forth to explain how this thing hit the ground, because, again, all the sand tests didn't work with the rope, right? You have fixed four pod legs. This camera that's filming me right now is three legs. If I had added a fourth on here, and then I take it out to a park where there's a sand pit, and I try to just toss it in any vector horizontally and try to get this thing to land without doing an extreme bucking and, you know, bucking back and forth, or it falling over, which is every experiment they ever did on camera with a faux setup in physics in the first place. This would have been the roughest landing ever. But someone told me that they had these boxes. I mean, it's a fairly brilliant idea, but again, they've had 50 years to talk about it and fake it now, 53. Metal boxes that were designed, as soon as the pads hit the base, it collapses the boxes, and thus the boxes take up the pressure. Now, that sounds all great and wonderful, okay? Couple things right off the bat. Some of the legs are going to hit hard, and some legs are going to hit soft. Some of the boxes would collapse, and some of the boxes wouldn't. And that means that at least a couple of these landings would have a cockeyed looking lunar lander. Even if the box would have to be, what, 12 inches minimum? We're talking about serious speed here, folks. When a human being jumps out of the old round canopy parachutes, I work with a guy that was, he was a beta tester for the old square canopies, which are now like standard. But he told me the difference between the two. And he says, I said, you know, well, what's it like? I interviewed him for hours. We worked at this pharmaceutical company together. And he said, well, you know, when we had to do the round ones, he goes, they're violent. And a lot of guys broke their legs because they didn't land right. And I was like, okay, I know nothing about this, dude. So lay it on me. He says, well, he goes, you're going to land, depending on the wind and how you control your parachute, whether or not you wobbled down or you went straight down. He goes, you could land anywhere from 10 miles an hour to over 20 miles an hour when you hit the ground. The ground is typically soft where we drop. We don't drop on concrete, anything like that. But he goes, you got to have your legs together, and then you've got to roll the second you hit the ground. And if you don't have all that set up, guys would break their femur bones, their leg bones, shatter their heels. It was bad. And so a lot of casualties in war was a guy laid up in the middle of a field, and there's not much anyone can do because they got to go. They got to get to a destination. So they try to stretch them out of there. But you got 10 guys down out of 50 dudes who jump out of like a dozen planes, you're going to have a problem. So when I did that math on these legs, and we're talking about a vehicle supposedly going 10,000 or 17,000 miles an hour, there's no way this thing doesn't just crater into the ground. But even with their little box theory, it makes no sense. Those landers landed absolutely level to the ground in every single shot I've ever seen. Now, what are the odds that in this incredibly, incredibly turbulent surface, and I know that everyone thinks the Sea of Tranquility is like an ice lake in Russia. It ain't, okay? One boulder, one rock, one crater is going to completely destroy the theory of how this thing is going to land. I'm going to tell you right now. I come from Kansas, in the middle of America. What's Kansas known for? Being flat. Because that's the way it looks. That's the way it looks just driving on the highway, let alone flying in a plane. If you go over Allen County, which my family owns some land in Allen County, one of the pieces of land we own is a big farming thing. It's nice and plowed, flat. Probably could pull off almost what we're talking about if you could get all the other magic science to happen, right? Which you can't. But we have this one piece of land that is just like it's like Hell's Elbow, man. It is the most rocky, hilly thing, but from the highway, it looks really smooth. But we got a vehicle out there once, a truck, and my grandfather was driving me around where the wells are, the oil wells that we have out there. He's long since passed, but we still have the land. And it was like, it was the most horrible ride on earth. I mean, the Indiana Jones ride at Disneyland and Disney World is smoother than driving in this truck on that land. If you got the lunar lander attached to a helicopter as a joke, nobody's in it. Nobody's getting hurt. And you say, hey, helicopter pilot, try to find one place to drop this down. You can't use the smoothed out area we did, that man did over by the oil tanks. You got to use the organic land that's here. Try to put this thing down so it's level. Even a moderately, acceptably level. He's not going to be able to do it. I'm going to guess a third of the time it's going to fall over because the land is so screwed up. But man, it looks flat from the sky, don't it? The moon looks super flat from here. The moon might even look super flat from some orbital satellite if they could even pull that off, which I don't think they could. At least back in those days. So, wow, we were the luckiest country on planet Earth to be able to put this lander vehicle with four legs with no ability to, you know, extend one of the tripod legs. If I had a hole in the ground and down 6 inches because someone dropped something heavy before I got here today, I could take one of these center rods and drop it 6 extra inches and it'd be nice and level for you guys. Nope, we don't have that technology. But what was one of the other characteristics about that movie we saw with all the dust flying away from the bottom of the vehicle out the window? Well, they screwed up, didn't they? When they put that lunar module, that lunar lander, excuse me, on the surface of this movie set, they must have used a crane because the legs were crystal clean. Crystal clean! And the nice thing about them using this shiny foil on all four legs was that if a shiny surface gets dust on it, it starts to become rough. The light doesn't reflect off it as much. No such problem for them, because it's not on the moon. It was a mistake they made in Apollo 11, which continued to be a mistake they had to recreate in all the other missions, except for 13, which didn't make it. So, back to the spinning thing. Imagine if this thing had any spin whatsoever. Have you ever watched a car crash video on YouTube? Guys driving straight down the highway. Big car, big heavy car. And someone comes up behind him and he's trying to pass. And they just bump the rear quarter panel. I've seen this happen with parked cars. Guys driving down the street, hits a parked car. He's just going 30. Instantaneously, that car crunches its quarter panel, hits the tire, tire's moving, boom, the thing ejects and rolls over on its top. For the ones that get hit from behind, oh my God, it's like the most chaotic craziness, and sometimes they can go sideways and go rolling 20 times down the highway. The guys who drift in Saudi Arabia or Dubai, looks like they're doing well until they lose control, and all of a sudden, the amount of force that's on this vehicle is so intense that they'll go from being looking like they're just going to swerve a little bit and stop the car. Nope, they go sideways just a little bit and the thing launches in the air like some Hollywood movie spinning in the air with these guys flying out because they won't put their seatbelts on. I think they're getting a little better these days. They're still roughed up though. So here comes this vehicle. And if it ever spun once out of 6 successful missions, then all the bets are off. And yet it's always perfect, isn't it? But they'll tell you these romantic stories that are easy to understand and easy to remember. And so people will divert away, like, look over here, look over here. There's just a little bit of bait. Then they just go, oh, well, you know what happened was, and they start changing the subject without even realizing it. Now, I was a science kid. I was a space kid. I believed absolutely everything was real until about 2003. Even though I was told in 91 that this was all bullshit by two NASA guys. I just, whatever, I don't know, I was a robot. I was a host in Westworld, man. My brain hadn't been activated for seeing anything different than I was already seeing it. Plus, I had massive accolades as a person for being able to memorize and repeat all this crap. So if you're in that phase, trust me, I know what it feels like. And I'm not happy that any of this isn't true. I'd rather them come out and say it didn't happen and then we can go back. But I think they've kind of spoiled it, like I said in my last video. So if that thing had been spinning and hits the ground, it would most likely, if they could get all this other fake science of slowing it down working, with this 10,000-pound thrust engine working in a zero atmosphere condition, that thing would just obliterate. It would just spin and obliterate. These astronauts would not be safe. Now, we got a couple other anatomy problems with this vehicle. Now, I've mentioned all this in previous episodes, or much of this in previous episodes, but I know you guys like it. But this is something to remember. I didn't know much about the engine designs that were out there at the time, the rocket engine designs that were out there, until there was a documentary recently made in the last 10 years. It's in Russian, and it was on Netflix, but it's all about rescuing these rockets from a Siberian warehouse that the Russians had made in 1972. In that documentary, they're explaining why these Russian-made 1972 rockets were so much better than NASA's 1995 engines. They talked about the meticulous nature of all those tubes that you see on the outside. That every single minute azimuth of a turn of a pipe can either make or break the engine. So they don't have time to make cosmetic rockets or, hey, we're going to take this rocket. You know, we got the straight up and down one that's really tall. Well, take the cone on the bottom of the Apollo vehicle, the lunar lander, and start doing your math up inside the vehicle. The average rocket design that was in every single rocket that you ever saw from the moment we first started launching big rockets in the 50s all the way up to 69, all the rockets were vertical, 100%. Which means you got to store a lot of fuel, because once you light that, it's like a match, dude. It's like lighting a solid-state rocket. It's not, but it's you can't turn it off once you stop it. I mean, you could probably turn it up, but I don't know if you could ignite it again. But anyway, it's got to go. You don't want to have a bunch of unspent fuel on a system as well. That could be really dangerous. If you have any landing problems, right? Kapow, boom, right? But they want you to believe that somehow in that little tiny bottom area, which is a lot bigger than you think it is, but they've got some. They got a tank of oxygen, they got a bunch of batteries, they've got a bunch of rocket fuel, and somehow the very mechanism that drives the engine is somehow laid up inside that container. It doesn't work that way. The engine would be in the living quarters with the astronauts. The weird thing is, if they were going to fake it, somebody, because I think it was so secret that this wasn't going to actually go, I think most people in NASA, and I'm going to say, I don't know, if there was 1,000 people, I would suggest that maybe 75 people out of 1,000 would know that this is not actually taking place. And it's for God and country, right, to beat those Ruskies, to bankrupt the Ruskies. And, you know, one way it worked. And it'll inspire kids to get into science, which it did. So you have an engine problem. You have a battery problem. You have a life support problem. I did the math on scuba tanks. The biggest scuba tanks you can rent in 2020. How much time does a diver get in the ocean with the biggest scuba tank on their back? Well, I found out there's two configurations. You can put one tank on your back or two tanks on your back. But if you get the biggest possible tank that could be attached to a human being's body, and you have to be a trained scuba diver in relation to breathing. I mean, you have to really lower your heartbeat. I used to do this as a lifeguard. You lower your heartbeat, and you can stay underwater at least an extra probably 20 to 30%. You're going to be starving at the end of that cycle. But you can get anywhere from 2.5 hours to 3 hours worth of air in these things if you're super duper trained. Imagine like Navy SEALs probably have that kind of training, but they got rebreathers as well. Well, they stayed on the moon a long time in the last mission. like 25 hours or something like that. Okay. Where's all the air being stored? Seriously. This thing should have just been a bunch of tanks landing with the tripod on it to last that long. With an umbilical cord back to the lunar lander so you can go off on a rover. No way to do this, folks. It would have been part of the script that these astronauts would have been checking their breathing supply constantly. Like every sci-fi show you've ever seen on TV, they would have been saying, Mission Control, I've got 30 minutes left. Well, you better head back because you need to switch out your tank. And how do you live without air, right? You'd have to have some auxiliary tube off the lunar lander, stick that in your chest spot so you got air. Make sure the thing on your back, this backpack that's supposed to be 100 pounds, is somehow disconnected, but it's on your back. I mean, they wouldn't even let guys hold a Hasselblad with a viewfinder in the top. It was welded to their chest, right? Or attached to their chest. So you'd have to have both guys go over. One dude, you both kind of go up to the surrogate umbilical cord to the master oxygen supply. And then you'd have to maybe, I don't know, recharge it. Put another toes in the back and watch some gauge go up and hope the damn thing doesn't break. Because it's the first time you've ever used such a thing in such a violent environment. Nope, none of that. Man, they never even talk about it. They never even talk about oxygen problems. They don't talk about any power problems. I didn't see solar panels on the first mission. I don't remember them talking about anything real. Do you? And no matter what protocol is on top of them. You got to take a piss. You got to poop yourself. They cut the radio every single time that actually took place when they're hungry. How many days can you go without eating, without mentioning it at least, right? Man, I'm really starving. You'd have to go back inside the lunar module. Close the doors. Oxygenate up. Look at all the gauges. Be talking about that whole process. You couldn't sit, most likely, in the seat with the backpack on. And you can't fit through the door when you're all inflated. Man, they got so many problems, don't they? But there was a void. And then there was a claim put in that void. Problem solved. They're counting on us being stupid back then and being stupid today. One could say ignorant, but there's too much factual information that you could read about and you have to change the way you think to keep in that ignorant phase, right? A 5-year-old today is ignorant. A 50-year-old today is stupid. If they're still hanging on to this crap. Now, a buddy of mine was born in the early 60s, and so he remembered seeing all this stuff on TV as a child and being absolutely enthused by it, right? I just re-listened to the episode we did on MKUltra Radio when he was talking about it, and he has just such a vivid memory of it. He's got a good memory anyway. But this was such a monumental moment and such an exciting moment that committing every word to memory wasn't that difficult. It'd be like going to Disneyland for the first time when you're 8 years old, even though your consciousness is just starting to come online. If you went to a fantasy location, you're going to remember those things. But he remembers them professing that this platform could not take even a paperclip more. That was how they expressed it when the Apollo 11 mission took off. Now, of course, these are newscasters, not scientists. The paperclip is obviously not exactly true, because that means if a guy brought a coin in his pocket, he'd make the whole rocket blow up. No, it's not literal. But I think that the rover, the moon rover, moon buggy, was 700 pounds. 700 pounds. And yeah, you might think, well, hey, what's the big deal? Everything's lighter on the moon, right? Well, it's not lighter on the ground on Earth. That's 700 pounds. Now, Saturn V is a big-ass rocket for the time. I would imagine it could probably pull it off, but they didn't redesign the F1 boosters. So either they miscalculated and didn't tell the public that, right? It would have been interesting if, right when, like, as Apollo 15 goes up, NASA discovered that the F1 Rocketdyne boosters were more powerful than they previously imagined with all the data they got from 11, 12, even 13, and 14, that they found that we could probably put on another 700 pounds. Wouldn't that have been a nice little press release? Nope. None of that stuff. Hey, these people are so fucking stupid. Just say whatever you want to say and they'll just believe it because they want to. So it gets to the moon, supposedly. There's a few problems with that moon buggy. Not the least of which, they never once filmed taking it out of its little compartment in the base area. And what the hell happened to all the stuff that's in there? Did they have a giant gap in there? Right? Maybe it's where the moon rocks are supposed to come back or something? Oh, no, wait, the moon rocks have got to come back in the top part of it because you don't get to bring it back to Earth unless they're up there. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. So that bottom area had a lot of free space in it. Okay. They had video cameras. Never pointed one at Earth the entire time they're on the moon. In six missions, they never pointed a video camera at the moon. Why? Because they can't fake it. Because they'd have to put Earth as a poster on the wall of this warehouse, whether it be a dome on the later missions, which is what I think actually occurred. I think it was a square box in the first one and a dome in later ones. Okay. Can't fake it. You can't fake it. One, because they don't have a shot yet to fake it with. Remember, they didn't offer the blue marble shot until Apollo 17, and it was a fraud. As I mentioned in the previous episode, Black Sea's all screwed up. Gosh, so easy to catch him, isn't it? But the first shot of the moon buggy on the surface of the moon, none of the tires have any track marks leading up to either reversing it backwards in for the shot or driving it forward for the shot. It's a clean, trackless shot of the front left quarter panel, I believe. The moon buggy itself has got some ingenious stuff to it. The tires were the part that blows me away. The rest is kind of kooky and stupid looking. I've heard two different theories about the frame that they used. One is just an old Army Jeep frame. That's the one I tend to believe. The other one was a Volkswagen frame. Whatever. I don't know why that makes it fake, necessarily, in itself, right? That's not a good, you know, smoking gun. Well, you know what they did. Well, yeah, why not, you know? But they should be welding something together. What's the big deal? But the problem is when you are operating in secret, you can't just go out and tell everybody. But they do. They did tell the world they're making these things. It just may not actually work in the actual delivery payload, unloading, unraveling thing. I don't know. But the other one about the lunar lander is the extreme heat and the extreme cold that is going to be hitting both sides of this vehicle no matter what. Now, according to NASA, and the number changes every once in a while, but when I first dove into this and watched millions of videos that were out there in, I think, 2015, episode 26, the temperature swings were something on the lines of 280 degrees Fahrenheit in the sun, and exactly the negative in the shadow. So negative 280 degrees Fahrenheit. All right. That's pretty cold and that's pretty damn hot. Now we know the spacesuits have a problem with that whole problem, right? How do you liquefy and balance the temperature of a suit such that getting that massive heat on one inside and massive chill on the other side is going to actually balance out? I don't think you can. I don't think you can. Plus, they have these gloves, these little rubber tips on the tip of the fingers. Well, could you imagine actually having a glove that was circulating just like a computer today, a desktop computer in 2022 that's got liquid cooling tubes in it, and somehow it's pulsing through your fingertips, and you're trying to get tactile feedback that you've actually grabbed something? How unbelievably advanced would that technology have been for 1969? It would have been off the charts. And that backpack? Well, how much battery power you got in that backpack, and where'd that technology go for the Tesla Motors company? Anything that were running off batteries. My God, if that was the case, to run all this environmental systems, and if you go look at the backpack's anatomy, it is hysterical, people. The tank for oxygen is about the size of a thermos of coffee. Remember the scuba diving thing? Impossible. And it's running and running and running. Plus, you're hopping around as an astronaut, supposedly. Falling down, getting up, breathing hard. You're breathing hard simply because you're on the moon. If you actually ever got there, you're going to be sucking down that tube a lot faster. And believe me, if anybody wants to suggest for even a moment, they train them astronauts to be able to not do that. Ask any soldier, if you're not one yourself. They trained you for combat, for the front line, especially as a Marine or more. You're a frontline Marine, and they trained you to go into Baghdad, to go into some hostile territory somewhere. How much of your breathing were you able to control during your first engagement when a bullet goes by your head and you can hear it ripping the oxygen? When the guy next to you has a thud in his body and falls on the ground. How much are you able to control your breath, people? And you talk about, that's a horrific satanic ritual of war. Now you're in a more godly endeavor of going to one of his celestial bodies, the moon. It's peaceful. You've been staring at this thing your whole life, and no man, according to the theory, up until 1969, ever touched the surface of the moon. Ever. And you're that dude with another guy, and you're controlling your breathing. No big deal. You could take a box of Valium and still be squirting in your pants a little bit when your foot hits the ground. It's going to be intense. And you could have the most stoic sort of Sam Elliott guy, and he's going to be a little girl when he puts his foot on the moon. It's going to happen. And if it doesn't happen in the first 60 seconds, it'll happen in the next 60 seconds. Yeah, I apologize for not having this guy's name on the top of my tongue right now, but apparently one of the nephews of one of the astronauts went to Cape Canaveral, as I understand it, and he went to a museum where they have one of the lunar lander replicas inside the museum. And it's a one-to-one scale replica of the lunar lander. Now, that's kind of laughable because that thing is as big as a house, man. It's big. But he was being toured through this museum. It might have been in one of the normal buildings, just exhibitioning pieces in the lobby and stuff, in the various hallways or whatever. But I've been there once. But he's getting VIP treatment because of his relation to his uncle. And he's looking around, and he has a little Easter egg snuck up his sleeve because he doesn't believe his uncle went to the moon. But he waits for it. It's pretty awesome. He waits for it. He gets all the good stuff out, all the little low-hanging fruits taken care of. And then he says, you know, could I get a little closer to this? This is 1-1 scale, right? Yeah, sure. And he says, well, I just brought a little cloth measuring tape with me. I just want to measure the door that my uncle crawled out of the lunar lander to get to the surface of the moon. And the guy's like, well, you know, it's all roped off and stuff. So he's like, well, let me go ask somebody if we can get through that barrier there. Don't want to piss anybody off, right? Now, I've heard the story told two different ways. The most romantic version of the story's conclusion was that when the guy left, he knew he was going to get in trouble, that he wasn't going to be at least allowed to get that close to it. So he walked up and starts trying to measure this thing himself. If nothing else, at least holding it in the air and getting close to it and going, holy shit, this is a teeny tiny hole. And there's no way that my uncle, in a spacesuit, inflated, could even remotely get through that door, that aperture. Not through twisting and turning, not through bending the shoulders a little bit. No way. He's like 6 inches to a foot short, depending on how the technique might be administrated to get through that. I think it's a square door, if I remember right, but it's probably square on the outside and round on the inside. I don't know. But the conclusion of the story is the same. Another official came back of a security nature and threw that guy out of the museum. With that original dude. And he was like, wow. They certainly seem to be worried about something. That they won't let me get close enough to measure it. What's fascinating about that story to me is two different things. It's either they did a background check on this guy, and I don't know what year this was. I got the sense it was prior to the internet really being a big thing. which allowed for a lot of social profiling and just psychological profiling of people because they just cough up their whole life online. Like, I would be easy to profile, just run all the episodes through an AI and they'd figure out who I was in seconds, right? But if it was before the internet, it's amazing that they realized, like someone realized, that you're not allowed to measure that thing because it's not real. Like, they brought more people in on the envelope of this is a hoax and we protect this. And you're so special to be protecting this hoax. Imagine that. Imagine someone being special to be on Satan's list, man. Oh, we got a spot for you, boy. We got a spot for you down here. So, you can even sit right next to Hillary Clinton. It's no big deal. We don't care. Yeah, I just, a saying occurred to me just now. I guess we're fortunate in a way that hell is soundproof. Because, man, if we could ever hear it for a split second. Imagine that hell hole in Russia. They dug this 9 mile hole, and then they lowered a camera down in there. And it's either an anomaly of, like, the burping lava down there, or, fuck if I know, it sounds like people screaming down in that hole. It's the weirdest thing, and I don't even quite believe that that's a real interpretation of hell. But if you haven't seen that video or heard that video, I should say, go look it up on YouTube. It's called, like, the Russian Hellhole. Listen to it, man. It'll disturb your soul. I don't give a shit who you are. It's like, whoa. Once you start realizing it's human voices screaming, if you interpret it that way, it's something else, all right? So now, just to clarify, and I don't think I've ever really clarified this, the moon buggies are all left on the moon. So those don't come back. No way to do it. The mechanism by which these astronauts return to orbit with the service module is the funniest theory you have ever heard in your life. Once you think about it, you're done. You're done with the entire moon mission. Just this one Achilles heel. As I have had it explained to me, and you've seen the shot, and everyone always asks me who was panning the camera up. That doesn't bother me, the camera actually panning up, but just to reset this thing, the only footage we've ever had is a camera far away from the lunar lander. The astronauts are supposed to be packed up nice and tight in that top module. And then an explosive bolt system of dynamite blows up underneath, which you see that scattering of metal. And that sends this module straight into the air. And in the shot that you see this, the camera actually pans up and follows it up. Now, technically speaking, I know some nerds on YouTube, I know a channel in particular that could probably simulate that with quite a bit of trying, but they could probably get that to happen on Earth too. You know, like a firework, or, you know, a Folgers can and a bomb, you know, or a trash can and a bomb. They could, after attempting it several times, could probably figure out the physics. If you use that trash can, this bomb, put that in a particular spot, we can make a camera pan up automatically. Again, that doesn't worry me too much. It's the entire theory of them returning to space with this mechanism that is just hilarious. How fast is everything going when it goes to the moon? I'll give you a window. For those of you who want to argue the actual specifics, I'll give you 10,000 miles an hour, the lowest, and 17,000 miles an hour at the fastest. It could have even been going faster if they'd actually pulled it off. So, 10,000 miles an hour, 17,000 miles an hour, anything in between. And here comes this box with astronauts in it. They didn't have their backs broken the second that these bombs go off underneath their asses, right? The kinetic transfer is going to occur. They would have to have the most amazing spring-loaded seats ever designed by man to throw them into space just to reach the height, okay, that this service module is going to be coming around. Because the moon has gravity too, folks. Anything that displaces ethereal winds creates a negative pressure. And you got an issue. You have gravity. But here comes the service module. It's in orbit at least 10,000 miles an hour. If you think that a slingshot mechanism slows a vehicle down, which means you should probably go back to school and not talk about these things until you complete it. Here comes this module straight up, like a target. Straight up, man. It ain't going left or right. It's definitely not going in an orbit. Oh my God, wouldn't NASA just do that today? Just shoot stuff straight up in the air and all of a sudden wind catches it or something, right? It doesn't work like that. So here comes this bullet with a cone on the back, 17,000 miles an hour, and here comes the lunar module capsule. Bam! Kaboom! Everybody dies. Like they said in Heavy Metal, you dies, she dies, everybody dies. Okay? That's what would happen. But you've seen this ridiculous footage. You've seen this ridiculous footage with the moon just screaming underneath, right? And here comes that module up. Somehow it's gained all this speed. And it's just, oh, it's just retro-rocketing around, pushing off of nothing. And then they connect together. Oh, gosh. Merca. The lunar module is a joke. It's a complete joke. And I'm going to say, I never really thought about it as much until Tim really mentioned it for the t-shirt. It's a joke in its entire conceptual design. The lack of creativity for this vehicle is a complete joke. When they realized they were going to fake it in a studio, that should have kicked off the designers to get way more creative. Why? It doesn't have to actually work. It just needs to extra make sense. Especially 50 years from now, because we know we can't do this again. Once the charade of this fake organization, not a space agency, okay, once that falls apart and you got to go off to space shuttle technology or some other thing, right? Rovers on Mars, right? Yeah. Uh-huh. Then maybe we don't have to talk about this a little bit, but eventually we're going to get pressure to go back to the moon. So the way that they run these scams is they keep saying they're going back to the moon. Again, if you were ever a subscriber to Omni Magazine, one of the coolest freaking magazines ever, you know that they auctioned off trips to the moon, all kinds of stuff. And people, you know, billionaires buying orbits to the moon. Mm-hmm. Where are all those missions? I mean, God, I think there's been two or three since I started this show. The billionaires are going to buy an orbit around the moon. Mm-hmm. Russia's going to take care of the problem. Yeah, sure. Remember the pattern. It's very, very important. Where they know society has a blind spot, which I'm calling a void, they can make any claim that they want, and you'll believe it. We got all kinds of voids all over the place. How do elections work? It's a void. How's money made and distributed? That's a void. Who owns the bank that owns the bank that owns the bank that owns the bank? That's a void. Believe me, like a time bandit map of all the doors through time. They've got a map of every void that exists, and I'm willing to bet they could create them from scratch. Invent a science you don't know anything about. What does everyone believe in climate change? Because there's a void in what the greenhouse gas layer index is. That's all you need. That's a smoking gun to knock that out of the water. It's every single chemical or material that contributes to the warming of the surface of the earth. 99.9% water. Infinitesimal fraction of a percent of CO2 created by everything on earth. And of that tiny 0.054% of a single percent, man contributes 2% if you give it half a point extra on that percent. If I chip that much off of a penny, or a pea in Britain, you couldn't even see it on a piece of paper. You'd need a magnifying glass to see it, a microscope. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about the lunar lander and the service module is outside of test footage where they're putting these modules together in a warehouse, which you only get to see through movies. You never seen one. Except for Cape Canaveral, where apparently the scale doesn't facilitate the mission. So these things are sort of out of sight, out of mind. Why these idiots don't fix things once they figure out the problems just shows you how crappy the government really works, right? The government is one of the most inefficient bodies on planet Earth. Any government. The other thing, too, is that the whole moon mission and the moon hoax is a third rail. I personally would not want to work for NASA or JPL and get a phone call from somebody that says, John, yeah, we got a hole that's pretty big and it's growing online about the moon missions. They found this Deep Thoughts radio show. We got a problem. We need you to get a bunch of guys together to think our way out of this because we got to debunk him. Yeah, we got Google and YouTube. They're censoring the shit out of the guy. But it's growing because it got recommended by somebody. It went mainstream. We're dead. This whole thing's going to unravel if we don't do something. Yeah, we thought about killing him, but his video's already out there. What the fuck? No point in doing that. And whoever that person is who gets that call, their life expectancy just went down by deep double digits. At least the underlings. I'd hate to be called to dig them out of that problem. This is such a bad hoax that is so easy to debunk now. That, you know, on this show, I always tell you guys, let's pretend like we're hired to do the bad thing, and then we can engineer how they might have done it so that we understand their thought process, their chain of command, whatever. I don't think if someone walked up to me and said, how'd you like to have $1 billion and you're willing to sell your soul and go to hell? If those two things sound good to you, then all you got to do is dig us out of all that shit you put in your show. We need you to do one more show and then in your channel where, or keep talking about how true it is, but you got to fix everything. I couldn't fix it. I couldn't fix this one. There are so many problems with this entire theory, from the launch to the orbital escape of Earth to how all these mechanisms work. Apollo 13 added a whole nother layer of shit to the shit cake, man. No explanation of what blew up on the outside of the service module. Out of a giant 3-inch report, one paragraph mildly alludes to something that might have exploded. It was kind of funny. A friend of mine, well, I thought it was this, and he mentioned some weird thing, and I'm like, where'd you get that from? I don't know. I'm like, well, the guys who were trying to figure out what really happened can't find anything more in a paragraph, and they're very brilliant people, you know. But all the anomalies, the oxygen problems, the battery problems, the thrust problems, the zero atmosphere problems, the moon buggy payload problems, the reentry problems of getting back into moon orbit problems, the rope memory stuff, right? They created this real dramatic story, which I think it's funny. I've been following this for a very long time. And I never heard about this rope memory all through my childhood. I never heard about it even existing until like maybe 5 years ago. Then all of a sudden it's everywhere. And all of a sudden a pedestrian was mailed. This is hilarious, man. A pedestrian was mailed through the fucking mail, supposedly, the actual rope memory from Apollo 11, because he had built a machine that was going to read the programming off the rope memory. Yeah, we do that. We do that. All the other mission data is all completely erased, including the schematics of the F1 boosters and the Sci-Fi platform. But these rope memory things, you can't call them disks or anything. And so there's a video, by the way, if you haven't explored rope memory. It's part of the lunar lander problem. I'm still figuring out a way to kind of bring it together to you guys, but maybe this is my first attempt here. There's an old movie. Looks like it was filmed in the 60s. They have this scientist I've never heard of who invents the rope memory. And they have all these women creating this almost loomy kind of threading. These big long needles, and he's got these crazy meshes. I mean, whatever it was so elaborate for the brain to conceive of. It was creating a void because what you're looking at, you really can't conceive. And being a computer engineer myself, being fairly decent in electronics, I'm trying to figure out how these wires are maintaining individual charges in a binary manner. And the idea that these things are still active in, what was it, 2018 or something like that, when this guy gets these packages mailed to them. Oh, well, you know, you wanted to look at the Mona Lisa, so we thought we'd ship it over to you. Yeah, and it just went through standard mail. Hilarious, man. If this shit was being analyzed, the guy would have to bring his computer system, which supposedly he has, and JPL doesn't have, and NASA doesn't have. I mean, they do employ some of the most brilliant academic people on planet Earth, entirely indoctrinated. At the same time, they get their trophy for their degrees, but it would have been white gloves. It would have been the press filming this. Someone would have bought the documentary rights to it for $1 million. Easy, because they could make $10 million off of it, just having in their library of viewable content, right? But it dawned on me, and I could be wrong with this, but I never seen a scientist in my life. I also had never heard of the Picard guy that did supposedly the balloon that went up to prove the world was flat. It is entirely possible, people. Depending on the history around these people, maybe you know a lot more about these people than I do, and you probably do. But unless your grandfather or whatever worked for these people, and maybe one of your grandmothers was one of the women that was actually making these machines, and it was videotaped, and you have personal, you know, souvenir pictures with these people. Maybe that exists. Okay. I'm really new to this research and it's hard to get anything confirmed. But when I was looking at the photographs of the Pascal guy and his balloon thing, boy, the photos really look new. Oh, it's old shit in the photos, but what do you mean? You can't build an old tricycle and then throw some dirt on it and say, look, this is a picture of a tricycle. One of those, actually not even tricycles, one of those big tires in the front, little tires in the back. Those guys used to drive around in the Gilded Era. You could build one today, dress a guy up, shoot it with an old camera. We still got them. We can still make film for them. We can take film that's crystal clear color and black and white the thing and then dirty it up and put all kinds of layers on it and it'll look like it was made in that time frame. But imagine if the Rote Memory movie, which if you look at the ladies making this thing, they all look really weird and nervous. No one's just like, I'm making rote memory. You know, like most Laverne and Shirley kind of assembly lines. Someone's kind of going, man, I'm on film. Man, that's cool. It's the 1960s, man, and I'm on film. That's cool. And I'm part of the Apollo missions. I mean, what, none of you ladies can crack a smile? Maybe there was a smile in the back I didn't see. But the scientist himself could be some newly engineered piece of history. Oh, yeah, you can find his Wikipedia. You can find old entries all over the place. Could be like manufactured history. You realize once history becomes entirely digitized, you just make up history and insert it in there. Oh, we just didn't see this. We didn't have a link to it at first. Oh, well, you know what? He's an unsung hero. We didn't make his page until way later. But supposedly when the lunar lander's landing in Apollo 11, the computer crashed. And it's got this automatic reboot mechanism. Now, I don't know about bugs that just disappear out of thin air, you know. Maybe it's some telemetry coming in, it's dividing by zero, or it's popping the float value in the computer or something. But we're talking about brain-dead computers. At that time, computers were still massive warehouse objects inside facilities. Mainframes, remember that whole thing? I mean, the theory of a mainframe is what the internet is today. They want to get you centralized on a mainframe, and you have a terminal at your house, you don't own any of your data. That was the goal. Why was Apple Computer revolutionary beyond measure, beyond its recognition? Because Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs made a company that brought it into your house. That's why. They were only copied later. Yeah, there's little Sinclair computers and all this other crap. Wow, you know, little flip switches in the front. That wasn't going to cause anybody to do any like massive development at home. They put that out there, and you know, very few people actually got those machines. Apparently Bill Gates got one. It's the last time Bill Gates ever wrote any code, trust me. But they tell you these romantic stories because they want you to get you off on something else. I don't know how many times I've talked about the evidence we didn't go to the moon. And the other person I'm talking about starts talking about aliens on the moon. Well, you know what? What so-and-so said, they saw aliens on the moon, and there's big towers on the moon. Well, they might be there, but we didn't see them in person. Trust me. Now, one of the other little factoids about the lunar lander, which is just hysterical, as I'm closing up here, was that NASA supposedly put a reconnaissance satellite in orbit around the moon to take pictures of the moon's surface to make it really nice and vivid, because they ran the scam on Mars, and boy, you bought a hook, line, and sinker, even though the Mars that they show you at NASA today and JPL looks nothing like the photographs we had for 80 years before they submit these new super high-res things, right? And I know the optics sucked back in those days, but you don't get black streaks all over these optics from the past with white all over the surface in different areas, and all of a sudden it's all gone, right? Even if you want to talk about blurring lens refraction and stuff, you'd have to show me how it's going to turn into the Mars that was in so many of the movies we've seen, right? Back in the 60s and 50s, where they were asking the same agency to give them pictures, right? But if they've created some type of UFO or something, you know, they have an anti-gravity system now. Well, they still got to account for all the other environmental issues. The Van Allen belt radiation, the ambient radiation from the sun. I mean, they're going to have to solve these problems at some point. Project Orion proved we didn't go to the moon, because they're still trying to solve problems that weren't even a problem back in 69 when they needed a light of the world. So that's the part I've been thinking about recently. It's hard to live for the truth when the world is so addicted to lies, isn't it? Especially people you love. And what I've found that's very interesting is that you've got folks that are for the truth up to a point. They're for morality up to a point. And then within their judgment system, they'll tell you something that they believe is dark and evil and something that's just unacceptable, anything. And then 10 minutes later, they hear about a violation in that same realm, whatever you're talking about, that is a clear violation of their standards based on a previous statement, but because they're in love with an actor, an influencer, they'll write a blank check to the whole thing. It's like they're still not over their addiction to the fiction, or to the facade, or to the Satanism, or whatever it is. It's difficult to wake up every day sometimes, depending on what kind of person you are, and what you're exposed to, and what you try to mulch in your head, and always stay true to your principles. Because we all slip up, we all get tricked into just paradigms of thought. And you'll be compromising your own values. And you won't even realize it. So what I find interesting about these conversations, where you have something you can really sink your teeth into, is it allows you to practice where what you stand for, which is really truth with a capital T, isn't it? It's a moving target. It absolutely is a moving target. So I love the fact that you folks love this subject matter, because I love it too. It's important to me. We're looking for the straw that breaks the camel's back. We're looking for the thread in the sweater to pull to unravel the whole thing. There are reasons why they have spent tens of millions of dollars trying to cover this up. Because it is an Achilles heel. It is the brick. If you pull it out, the whole Tower of Babel hits the ground. It's one of many. One of many. What's interesting about the moon mission, as opposed to maybe JFK's assassination or something, you could tell them about the kid in the rain drain taking the headshot. Well, only Americans would even potentially give a crap about that. Yeah, there's a lot of foreigners that liked JFK as well. But that generation's dying. So it's just a foregone conclusion. The moon mission's interesting because it seems to onboard new audiences every single year. But I give you a double standard I see all the time. Got people that think, for sure, we didn't go to the moon. And you hear this stuff, and they're absolutely, totally believing that. But then they will say, Well, did you see the new rover on Mars? Did you see they launched a helicopter? Did you see this and that and this? And you're going, hello? Like, are you there? Do you realize that we've just nailed a giant portion of any platform that has to leave the Earth's gravitational force? If their whole theory of everything in cosmology is true, you're not going to get to Mars. The amount of error correction you would need to get to Mars is so exponentially mind-blowing. And they don't explain it. They don't explain how you correct a trajectory that's off, because you can't, because you're in a vacuum of space. I mean, you got ethereal particles everywhere, but again, unless they have an ethereal engine, that's a vacuum for them. So anyway, that's all I got for you today. Hope you dig it. Again, I'm trying to bring quality because I'm only doing one episode a week, but I have been so disgustingly busy. I took this whole camera rig to a friend of mine's house in Pasadena thinking, man, it'd be easy to pop on an episode in the middle of the day. I stayed there 2.5 days. I did not have a chance to cut a video once, and I was up till 3 o'clock every night. So if you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, please go. I'll give you the short bumper. Everything's up there. Go up and take a look. Just remember there's a store. And for those of you who want to help the channel out, just go to patreon.com. It always helps. I pay for a lot of sticks and technology to keep the show going, software updates and all that kind of stuff. So it all comes in handy. I really appreciate you guys hanging on during this bonus season. But anyway, take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over and out.